Howdy and welcome to River Talk, hosted by Priscilla Macy, Zach Collier, and me, Eric Weissa. This week, our big topic is baseline safety principles and just sort of like main things to think about in safety. But before we start with that, we've got some news of the week. So, Zach, Priscilla, what do you got? Anything?
I don't think I have anything this week. Sorry, I've been behind on things.
Well, you were at the Green Race. Tell us about that.
Well, we already talked about that last episode.
When I wasn't
unfortunately,
here.
Eric, when you weren't here, you haven't listened.
I was on the river, all right. I was on a 4-day lower salmon trip, freezing my butt off.
So yeah, since then, not much has happened for me.
Gotcha.
Other than, let's see, at the end of this month, actually, I do have a little bit. At the end of this month, the REI flagship store in DC is having a Wild and Scenic Rivers celebration. And I'm going to be going there with a few other American Whitewater folks to celebrate that and also to advocate for some federal level policy for wild and scenic rivers, including the Oregon Wildlands Act.
Awesome. Very thank cool. you. So. Thank you for doing that.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it'll be exciting.
I had a few sort of news of the week things that caught my attention. One was I saw the Oregon State Marine Board has, you know, I think maybe they heard our advocacy for a better PR campaign to talk about, you know, what they're doing and why they want to, you know, get a funding program for non-motorized boating and stuff. And so I got an email, you know, talking about their new sort of advocacy program they're going to have and how there's going to be some videos. They're going to do a bunch of cool stuff and reading through it originally. I was like, oh, this could be cool. And I clicked on the link for one of the videos and it was anything but cool. It was highly informative and like A+ for effort and thought, I guess. But, you know, it was, I think the new executive director is just like a, you know, sort of selfie camera video of him talking about what they're doing this year. And it was like, I want to support you guys so badly. Like, I believe in what you're trying to do. And this makes it so hard. So that's really all I have to say about it.
Eric, did they even, wait, you think that they did that in response to our podcast?
No, I doubt it, but okay. I'd like to think so.
Okay. All right. That's what I was wondering.
Who knows? Maybe.
You have that much influence.
Right?
Yeah. I think it's the classic government entity problem that I've begun to see happen more often, is there's a strong desire to engage in the public in more meaningful and relevant ways. And a lot of the agencies are realizing social media is a great way to do it, but none of them are marketers or videographers. So they're basically just trying to do this new thing that they know should work, but don't necessarily have the best strategy or resources to do so. So I think, like Eric said, it's a great thing to be doing, and it's a great way that agencies should continue to try to inform the general public about, you know, this week in the Marine Board, this is what we're doing, or blah, 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 so people actually pay attention. But yeah, making it a little more exciting and a little more of a production to the limit that your budget will allow. But yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's hard to, I'm sure they don't have a budget. I'm sure none of them are experts in this, but neither am I. And I'm pretty sure I could make something that's more entertaining.
Okay.
Sounds like they should hire
Eric. Let's see you do it. So
I'm not going to go on another project right now.
Yeah. I'm going to take their side on this to play devil's advocate a little bit. It's hard to video yourself talking about things. And I'm just glad I did something. You know, agreed. Now I know what the mm-hmm. – I didn't get the email. You sent it to me, so I watched it. And yet he's not exactly inspiring, and it's not exactly a top-level video, but it's better than nothing, right?
I would hope so.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what we said last time, right? When they were trying to pass – when they were trying to advocate for that bill last time that was going to create this whole funding program and everything else, it was like the stuff they're putting out is better than nothing. But the problem was that in the end, it wasn't, because – there ended up being all sorts of misinformation everything else, right?
But,
and so
but I think, like, it's like this podcast. I bet if we went back and listened to our first 10 episodes, or maybe even like our most recent ones, we're practicing. We're learning how to do it, right? We're not podcasters, but we get better every time. And hopefully he gets, I mean, it's probably maybe his first video ever. And if he does 20 of them, he'll get more comfortable, at ease behind the camera. And hopefully a year from now, they'll be really good, or at least mediocre. You know, that's kind of how I feel about the podcast. If we do this for a year, at the end of a year, we'll at least be mediocre and like tolerable.
Hopefully.
And every time we do it, we're getting better. So I'm going to support them in continuing to do this as an exercise in do better than them doing nothing.
Totally agree.
Yeah.
That's our statement of
we believe in you. We believe in you. I think something also as a word of encouragement is often I think agencies and people that work in government are afraid to try something new because they know that the number one response is going to be criticism and you suck.
Yeah.
So I think it's great that they are trying to do something versus just making excuses and saying no because it's easier and you're subject to less scrutiny. So
that's well, a really good point, Priscilla. The motivation is to do, it's better to do nothing than something. And I think you're totally right. They're taking on something that's great. So
yeah,
I think what they're trying to do, what they're trying to create a messaging around and what they're trying to accomplish is good. And so, you know, just all for them doing that and getting there.
Yeah.
Keep on keeping on. So my other news of the week, I was, I don't read outside very often because more often than not, it's not great, but, I was flipping through, had nothing going on. So I was reading like a print edition, like the actual physical magazine, which I think usually does have some good journalism that happens in there. And there was an article that I tried to find online, so I have to post it, but then I don't think it is online. I think it's only in the print. And the article is titled, "This Land is Our Land, Outdoor Industry, It's Time to Embrace Hunters and Anglers as Political Allies in Conservation Battles." And, you know, basically is the premise that the sort of the rafters, backcountry skiers, sort of the action outdoors people, or even, you know, hikers and that kind of stuff, tend to be at odds, it seems like, with the hunting angling crowd, even though in the reality a lot of our goals around conservation and land use, you know, our desire to use the land and things like what we're using it for is very different, but how we want it protected and stuff is very aligned. And yet there seems to be this sort of dislike of each other and different communities. And, you know, he talked about Yovan Chouinard from Patagonia going to a conference really oriented towards like the sportsman side and talking about how we need to be partners in this and that really we're more aligned than we think and all of that. And it was a really great article because I personally, like with where I live now and participated in like Idaho Hopper and Guides Association, which is an organization of rafters and hunters, primarily, like two very different groups. And yet I'm consistently getting to see the alignment between these people of what we want, how we want the land to be protected and all of that. Like there is this huge opportunity for working together to protect the places that we all love, even though we use them for different things. There's room. We can be significantly more powerful as partners than we can be as enemies towards our common goals.
Yeah.
So
I totally agree.
That was a piece that really caught my attention. And now having, you know, moved to Idaho and just being around that more often and like living in a kind of a rural community where hunting and fishing is a much bigger thing. And yet getting to see how they all advocate for protection of these places. I think that there's a real opportunity there.
Yeah. I think something that I've noticed in having similar conversations with agencies, outdoor industry folks, and just general users is there's this for a lot of groups that don't fall into the hunting and angling crowd, what I have determined to call it is like the sense of privilege for use of public lands without putting in the capital needed to maintain them or manage them. So for example, like a conversation that I had was, I think their primary activity was hiking and they didn't understand why these sites kept getting closed down and restrooms were getting closed down. But also in the same sentence, they were mad because they had to pay $5 to go visit a trailhead, where if you think about the amount of money that ATVers, hikers, or sorry, ATVers, fishers, and hunters pay to maintain access, law enforcement, and facilities. It's the scale is so inequitable in terms of how much they're paying into the system when certain user groups are merely paying parking fees, and in a lot of cases not happy about having to pay those parking fees, and are also mad when the restrooms are closed. So it's an interesting, I think, construct of what different user groups view public lands and also view as appropriate to be contributing in terms of money to the public lands and the agencies managing them.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of interesting ones when it comes to like trail use. You know, I was reading something, I was reading about a trail here out of McCall that I want to go ride up off of, above the South Fork of the Salmon. And, you know, there was like kind of comments on the trail and things. And one of the comments was like, if you see some dirt bikers come by, don't give them the stink eye and, you know, like try and run them off the trail, because the reality is it's the dirt bike groups that probably have gone through and maintained the trail and cut out all the downfall and all that kind of stuff. Which is totally true around here. Like that is a thing that happens. Like, and those are the groups that do a lot of the maintenance on some of this stuff. And then, you know, there's a test case with the Forest Service, and Zach, maybe you can speak to this a little better, but I know that the Frank is one of the places where it's going to be tested. Is, you know, there's so many trail backlogs throughout the country where like the Forest Service isn't maintaining trails. And so one of the things they're going to do is offset use fees for like, you know, outfitters who use those trails to go out and maintain them. Mm-hmm. And so all of these trails that are used by the public are going to be maintained in part by, you know, a lot of hunting outfitters who utilize those trails. So that benefits everybody. So all that to say, I think that there's a lot more, there's an opportunity for us to play a lot nicer with each other than we do a lot of the time.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm 100% agree. And I think that we need to, we can do this by speaking their language. You know, when we show up in our Patagonia outfits and our colorful jackets and our Subaru Outbacks, and then we meet a bunch of dudes in Dodge trucks and Carhartt jackets and, you know, guns, we don't mismatch. You know, it's a weird, awkward setting. And I think that we need to like find that common ground with them and make time to make friends with these groups. And it's hard just because we speak a different language, we wear different clothes, we act differently. But I think for success, because if we want to pass public lands bills, we need to get Democrats and Republicans on board. And to get Republicans on board, you need anglers, hunters, ATVers behind it too. And I think that's the low-hanging fruit right now, is making friends with them. So I'm personally excited to try to work with more people that are different than I am, but still love out the outdoors.
Yeah, no, totally agree.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was one of, like, ever since I started going to IOGA, that's always been like my favorite thing about that conference, is you have kind of like the dirtiest of the Subaru hippie liver, like river guides, like hanging out with some very hard sort of Idaho backcountry cowboys, and everybody like loves hanging out and getting along. And, you see that alignment in, like, this one, there's sort of this one microcosm where these super left-wing Democrat kind of people and these super right-wing Republican kind of people, in a lot of ways, are actually much more centrist because of their, you know, the things they commonly value.
For those of you that don't know, IOGA is the Idaho Outfitter and Guides Association. Eric's on the board of directors, and it's a group of it's an organization that represents guides and outfitters in the state of Idaho. And we have an annual conference every December. It's a couple weeks away, and it's a really fascinating melting pot of chaco wearing hippie river guides. And, you know, dudes in cowboy hats and cowboy boots. And we all have a common goal, and that's to promote outfitting and guiding in the state of Idaho and to work with the state of Idaho to bolster the economy through outfitting and guiding in the state. Does that sound right, Eric?
Yeah.
Yeah, fair enough.
And my goal, one of my favorite parts of the conference is that there's ways to win guns. I'm a gun owner, but I don't go shoot guns. It's just not, I mean, I own them because I'm, you know, that's what I do. But I don't go shooting them, you know, like that's not a thing that I enjoy necessarily. But at that conference, there's three different ways to win a gun. And every
raffles
year,
and such.
Raffles, and every year I try to win a gun. And my goal is to leave that conference with a gun in my hand that I probably won't shoot, but it's funny to me.
If you want to get into that, our fundraiser is the last night of the conference, and you could just like get on Facebook and type in the IOGA thaw in Boise. Yeah. It's like the second week of December, and you can come to the fundraiser and buy a raffle ticket and see if you can win yourself a shotgun or whatever.
No, don't buy don't sell more raffle tickets, Eric. I need every chance I can get to win.
And so kind of going along that line, there was news, this just came out a couple days ago here in Idaho, which matters to some of our probably more hard boating community folks, like drift boats and such. The state of Idaho came out and said that right now it looks like they're probably going to shut down steelhead fishing for the foreseeable future. It closes here on December 7th, midnight December 7th, and they have no projected opening date for 2019, which is a huge deal. There's a lot of summertime river guides here who make their wintertime living guiding steelheading, like on the salmon and other places. And the reality of that being shut down for the year is a tough deal. Apparently the state has been operating, you know, this is based on the news reports. And so what I've read makes it sound like the state has not been operating legally with some regards to the Endangered Species Act. And there's some paperwork things they got to change. And it's not like big stuff, but there are some things they need to do to get within compliance.
Wow.
And so they got Idaho Rivers United and a couple other organizations basically sent them a letter and said, if you don't fix this in 60 days, we are going to file a lawsuit against you. So we haven't actually filed it, but we're going to. You just need to fix these things to get within compliance. And the state instead said, we can't deal with having, you know, the likelihood of a lawsuit out there, so we're just going to shut it all down. So there's sort of this back and forth where they're blaming Idaho Rivers United and others, and Idaho River United is blaming them, and it's this whole thing. And the unfortunate loser in it is both, you know, like diminishing steelhead and salmon runs, because, you know, kind of the things the state has been doing to protect them haven't made a difference in 10 years in those returns. And then the people, the local communities, the small communities like Riggins and Salmon and those places who their restaurants, their hotels, like all of these other people make livings off of people coming and angling throughout the winter. And the guides.
And so, this is something where the Idaho Outfitters and Guides Association can step in to help, right? You guys are doing something, I'm assuming.
I mean, this news just came out like a couple days ago, So unclear. I don't know. At this point, honestly, like I'm sure it's going to be a topic of conversation when we meet up in the next couple weeks. But yeah, it's a thing for sure here in the state. So if you're in Idaho, that is the thing. I think that you guys have any other news of the week?
Oh, I have one thing. I want to just mention Cascade Outfitters, which is also Moravia Rafts. They have an annual Capture the Raptor contest where you can send in photos, and if you get picked as a top photo, you win a $10,000 raft package. It's crazy. I don't know how they can afford to do this, but if you want to enter some photo of you rafting through the year to maybe win this package, just go to the Cascade Outfitters website, and there's information about it there. What I don't get is why they give away a $10,000 raft package every year to the winner of this contest. That seems like a crazy amount of value for a photo contest.
I think I thought about that too. I really like the contest. I think how they're able to justify it, and I'm sure after a number of years they're able to quantify it, is that the marketing that comes around that promotion and the engagement and the number of people that become more interested in their shop probably has a value associated with it. And then they also own any of the submissions of photos that you send in. So they're saving money on having to have basically printed content, which, you know, if you're a big company and you do a lot of printed content, hiring a photographer and models and all that costs a lot of money. Yeah. So I think they're probably evaluating $10,000 in marketing cost and then foregoing some other things that they might do in terms of promotion throughout the year.
I think the powerful part of that isn't even the photos. It's when you do your submission, they also wanted an explanation of like why the photos is important or why it means so much to you, or, you know, your relation to rivers or whatever it was. And so they're getting these phenomenal quotes from people about like why they love rivers, why they love rafting, like why is this so important to them? And that's some incredible content. Like that to me is as valuable as the photos. photos themselves, probably, especially for, you know, definitely, business selling river stuff. So,
and it's real, which more people want now. They don't just want some silly made up quote. They want a story about a family and their kids going down the river. Yeah. That's genuine.
Priscilla, did you
enter? Yeah, it's a cool contest.
Did you enter, Priscilla?
Not this year. I have in the past. I probably should enter something this year. I like to do it just for fun, not expecting to win anything, but it's always fun to go through your photos and see if anything you think might win.
There's 6 more days left, so if you want to enter, you should. This morning,
okay.
So this morning what I did was I went through all my photos from the year and deleted the ones that were stupid. So it was a fun morning to, you know, because you have like several thousand photos and you want to get down to a reasonable number. So I just cut tons of photos, but as I found cool ones, I sent them in. So I did my 6 entries this morning. And yeah, it's fun. Awesome. I mean, I think I like last year, one of my photos was in consideration at some point. So it was cool to see that. I like the contest. I don't, you know, it's hopefully a lot of people are signing up for it and doing it.
Yeah, definitely. Well, should we move on to our main topic?
Yeah.
So main topic this week is what Zach's calling baseline safety principles. And basically just a conversation around, you know, as you're going boating, what are sort of like the very basic level things you should be considering when you're making a choice to go boating today? Like, what are those? We're not getting into any sort of higher end, like rescue sort of stuff. More the what should you be thinking about to not become a victim or to deal with the sort of everyday things that come up when you're going boating.
I have a
good way to frame that.
Yeah, I have a list of what I think are like the absolute like key ones, and we can kind of talk about these if you guys want to. But they're like always wear a PFD, don't drink, wear shoes, and don't boat by yourself. That's to me like that to me is like the baseline safety stuff. Priscilla, do you have more to add, or do you disagree with some of those?
Well, I have some more to add. I think the blanket statement, don't boat by yourself, is neglecting a deeper conversation about solo boating. So I think as a baseline rule, and when I used to teach whitewater rescue, of course I would say that. But I think having more experiences and having done some solo boating and gotten a lot of reward from it, and there's also just a different way about thinking about running a river when you're boating by yourself and learning, that I think is incredibly valuable if you are at a skill set that you are able to do that. So I wouldn't blanket statement don't boat alone, but of course if you're someone that's not a class 4 or 5 boater or someone who has experience with rescue and knowing the risks that you're taking on, like, definitely don't. I think adding things to it, the basic principle of staying warm is a big one. And for me, a lot of boating safety stuff also comes to like transportation. So if I'm traveling in the middle of nowhere, making sure to have basically a self-contained jumper cable set, a tire inflator slash, you know, fix a flat, AAA, all that kind of stuff. Because I feel like some of the more sketchy situations I've maybe been on have involved being on the road versus on the river. And so being prepared for that is something that, and like having extra food in your car in case you get stranded in the snow, or extra water being even more important than that. And then warmth. Oh, at least if you're someone like me, where you get cold really, really quick, that can alter your safety really quickly. Always having a throw rope. This goes from like if you're a supper, if you're a hard shell kayak or a rafter, always having a throw rope, even if it's an easy river, you never know when you're going to come across someone in trouble.
Wait, let's go back a sec. There's like several things I want to comment on. First of all, do suppers have to carry throw bags?
Legally?
I think if they're on a whitewater, no. But I think just ethically, if you're on a whitewater river, if you, like, I feel really bad when I forget my throw rope, even if it's an easy river and I'm not in a kayak, or if I'm not even like the leader of the trip, just because there's been a few times on the river where you run into someone who, you know, like I'm thinking of like the middle white salmon, where somewhere we're like, oh, like I forgot my throw rope, no big deal. And then all of a sudden someone who's just learning how to kayak is stuck in a hole or swimming.
So for me, I
And
when
you're the only one
when I
there.
was learning this up, none of us carried throw bags because there's not really a place to put them. Like there's not, you can't like tie them on the
Not
board very
even the
easily.
back, like the
Yeah,
back one.
I don't. Well, I use the rope that attaches me to the sup that's already on my back, and I just don't like carrying the back ones
Oh.
myself. So and when you're supping, there's like four of you supping. Throw bags don't really help other suppers that much. It's you're not like you're rarely throw banging other suppers because you're already tied to
Yeah,
a
well, yeah.
boat. So it's not something that
You have a
we were
giant
using,
floaty thing.
yeah, that's already tied to you. So when you go out like three or four suppers, having a throw bag with you seems kind of useless. But one time, now that you mentioned the white salmon, I was supping the white salmon with a kayaker who swam. I think it's waterspout, has that kind of nasty hole, if I remember right.
Yeah.
It's waterspout, and there's a.
Yeah, depending on, yeah.
I was eddied out there, and a kayaker was getting beat down in the hole and swam in the hole. And I've just stood there without a throw bag. And that moment is why
Yeah.
I started carrying a throw bag as a supper. Because I could not help that person that I
Yeah.
was with in a kayak. If it was a supper, they would have just flushed out. But because of a kayaker I was with, I started carrying mine. But it's hard to carry a throw bag as a supper.
Yeah. I just think the consequence for not having one, even, people can make the argument, well, that, if within my group we're set, that's fine, but I think the cost of not having a tool like that is too high potentially.
So
Like someone getting stuck in a hole and drowning,
I'm with you.
even if you don't know them.
I'm a huge fan of throw bags, and that we shall. It's like the best tool for us to
Yeah.
have to save other people, to do some sort of like rescue or whatever. It's like the number one tool, but it is adding danger to a situation. Should some people not have throw bags? Like, do you think that you should have some minimum level of training before? Because they could actually make things worse, and there's examples
Well,
of
yeah. If
fatalities.
you own, it's just like any tool, I think, especially when it comes to rescue tools, you should certainly know how to use it, whether it's something is, not everyone can afford an expensive whitewater rescue class, and not everyone has the time to attend those classes. But fortunately, in the age of YouTube, there are so many videos out there, so just making sure you're actually watching a video from a reputable group, like the ACA, NRS has some rescue videos of like how to pack a throw bag, how to throw a throw bag, and there's also Rescue 3 has a bunch of videos online that you can watch. So definitely, if you, it's just like having a rescue PFD. If you don't know how to use it, it can cause a lot of harm with the release belt. So just simply reading the manual, watching a YouTube video, reading blogs, you should definitely do that before being in a whitewater situation where you're required to use it.
So
And practice using it in your yard or your driveway.
let me ask a question then. If people have not done that, should they have a throw bag? If they're just like learning to kayak, they're like class two or three kayakers, and they don't know enough about them, should they carry one? And this, I don't know the
No.
answer. I'm just asking you guys the question.
The one death that I have personally come across and tried to stop. I came across a scene where a guy had tried to swim with a rope in his hand to get to the shore and pull his boat off the rocks. Like the rope, he was in a situation where he was perfectly alive until he started to use a rope, right? And didn't think about the consequences of what he was doing because he wasn't trained and all that kind of stuff. Like
Yeah.
I'm a big believer that ropes are one of the most dangerous things we play with on the river. And you can kill yourself or hurt someone else very, very quickly trying to be helpful if you don't think and haven't
Yeah.
evaluated what can happen with a rope. A rope is an incredibly dangerous thing on the river.
Yeah.
And so I'm a huge believer if you haven't had some sort of formal training or, gone through whatever that looks like for you, where you've really evaluated and learned about how to use this, how is the tool and how it can be a danger, you should really think twice about whether or not you should carry one.
I think we should
Like
have
I've seen
a,
situations where
yeah.
swimmers have become in worse scenarios because someone threw them a rope. Like I
Yeah.
think that's a rare situation, but it does happen and it can happen.
Yeah. I also think if you're paddling whitewater, there's a certain number of things you need to do and learn before you're doing basically more than moving flat water and learning how to have basic rescue, self-rescue, and throwbag skill set is one of those things. Just because you don't know how to use a rope doesn't give you an excuse not to bring it on the river and not to get yourself the skills needed to be an asset on the river versus a liability to yourself and others.
Totally right.
So Priscilla, I think what you're saying is you shouldn't go boating on whitewater until you have that experience with throwbag.
Yeah, unless, you know, there's exceptions. If you're in a class, if you're having a mentor literally taking you on the river and teaching you those skill sets while you're on the river, obviously that's an exception. But if you're asking other people to go boating with you, or you're boating in your own group of friends that's all learning together, you absolutely should take responsibility for yourself and just in general being in a risky environment, which is moving water. So don't put others at risk and don't put yourself at risk without having basic skill sets, including knowing how to use a throw bag.
I think we should do a whole episode about throw bags. Like get somebody who's like known expert who we all trust and ask them questions like this.
Yeah. Cause I, you know, you think about like, we have a big rental business, right? And we send out hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people in inflatable kayaks every summer on like the day stretch of the Rogue Class 2. And we don't send out throw bags with them. And I would never do that. And, you know, every now and then, maybe there's a scenario that like at Argo at low water where, you know, people would be better off if they had a throw bag or something, but it's so very rare. And the risk to me is way outweighs the, you know, potential benefit that these people are going to have. Like they're on a class 2 river. Like, I don't think, same thing, like we rent rafts, whatever else. I think there is some consideration of what you're paddling, where you are, not just what your skill set is, as to whether that's an essential piece of equipment like a PFD is.
Yeah, that's definitely a tricky line, especially when it comes to commercial and rental businesses, is you obviously want to give people the opportunity to rent and enjoy the river, but you don't necessarily want to take on teaching them a basic safety class every single time they rent a boat. So yeah, that's a complicated issue for sure.
And one piece I would add, as far as like basic equipment, you know, like Zach says PFD, like we're talking super basic, like PFD for sure. Like you shouldn't be on a river without a PFD ever. Doesn't matter what your craft is, like period. Yeah. Whereas like a throw bag, I think about, you know, I've been inflatable kayaking a long time. And I think the only time that I've ever felt glad that I had a throw bag when I was inflatable kayaking was like, when I was getting on the fence at Blossom to help pull somebody else off, and I had my throw bag so I could throw it to shore versus them trying to throw one out to me, you know, to then help rig up like a Z-drag or something. But as far as like rescuing people, the inflatable kayak, if you know how to use it, has always been a better tool.
Like go get them instead of throw bag.
Throw rope. Yeah. Right. You know, like, so there is some consideration of that. Like same thing with the supboard. Like that is a big platform you can pull people up on. Like there's, if you have the skill set, sometimes the throw rope, like there's always this go-to, I'm going to grab a throw rope, like that's going to, you know, solves all. Yeah. When I think there's a lot of scenarios where it's actually the wrong tool. And the knowledge on how to use some of the other tools you have may prove better.
I mean, I think that when we think of throw bags, we think we're going to rescue somebody right above a class 5 rapid. Like they swam and we have to pull them ashore before a class 5 rapid. Or we think that somebody's getting beat down in a hole and we're going to pull them out of the hole. I think that's what's in our brain. But what we actually use it for is to like hang a line and camp to dry our clothes. Or pull boats up a hill at the end of the day because it's a long hill. Or it gets used for a lot of other things that aren't necessarily safety. Or getting lines to a if a boat's stuck in the river, getting a line there.
I think it's important to delineate the difference between the types of boating, though. In class 4 or 5 whitewater, I mean, I've probably thrown my throw bag 200 plus times, and Jacob's probably closer to like 1,000. So depending on the type of boating you're doing, and like Jacob and I IKing, there's been times where I've gotten stuck in a hole and body recirculated in an IK where Jacob would have never been able to get to me without a throw rope. So I think depending on the type of whitewater and the topography of the area, are like, you know, what's the landscape? What are the dangers downstream? What are they, boulders? Are they holes? Yeah. Is it a bedrock canyon? Is it a waterfall? Like, what's the likelihood that someone could get to you in a boat, if at all?
So Priscilla, of the 200 throws, how many of those were to a swimmer in the river versus how many of them were just like pulling a boat up out of a canyon on a portage or something? Was it 200 people in the water like saving them, or was it like 50 people in the water saving them? And like a bunch of other extraneous reasons.
I think a lot of them were people swimming.
Okay.
And then a few of them were like to the other side of the river so that we could extract a pinned boat or try to finagle a way to get a boat out of a hole. Like I'm trying to think of other complicated ones, like throwing across the river to attach to another throw rope to create kind of like an angle. But a lot of them are just people who are learning or are, you know, trying to step up, end up swimming in a somewhat, like even Opal Creek is, when it's not incredibly low, is a pool drop river, but it's continuous enough and cold enough that you want to get a swimmer out soon as you can. And, you know, that's just a classic class four run, and I've thrown my throw bag on that probably more than most rivers just because it's what I do, and there's often people stepping it up, or that's the hardest thing they do all year there.
Yeah. Okay, let me try to summarize this whole thing and see if you guys agree. If you are a boater and you're going boating, like you're a legit player, you should have a throw bag and you should be trained. That's just a no-brainer. We all agree with that. If you're somebody who's sort of an apprenticing, you're learning how to boat, maybe you shouldn't have one. But you should know that before you become a boater, before you become like a real out there real person, you need to train yourself and the use of it, which maybe that's through a safety class, maybe that's through NRS videos. I hope it's not NRS videos because I don't know. That for some reason that sounds weird to me. But
they have really good, their duct tape diaries have awesome videos.
Okay, cool. I haven't watched them, so hopefully they're good. But hopefully if you're making that transition from like apprentice / learning how to boat to like, hey, I'm a real boater who's going to go out on my own and meet people, before you make that step, buying a throw bag and learning how to use it is an important step.
Yeah.
Does that sound like a good summary? Yeah. And if you're, once you start boating like hard stuff, like class 4 or 5, like Priscilla does, then you should expect to be using that often. And it's a regular tool you use day to day. Does that sound adequate?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah. I think like, obviously you hope not to be using it day to day, but if you're running difficult stuff with different types of people, you should always practice anticipating where bad stuff might happen.
Yeah.
And I think something to add to your summary that is related to what Eric said is sometimes a throw bag, well, you know, oftentimes a throw bag isn't the only tool you can use and not getting stuck up on. It's the same issue that when we're rafting, we're like Z-drag right away for everything.
Yeah, that's right.
Is sometimes just kicking the boat off the rock works, or sometimes just extending your paddle to someone works, or paddling in an IK to grab a swimmer work. So the more you boat, start thinking about what's the simplest way to execute a rescue and what's the way that makes the most sense, and not just falling into the trap of thinking that one method or one tool works for everything.
I totally agree with that. That's a good addition. Thank you.
Yeah. So back to basic principles. So ideally, the point before you need the throw rope, like what are the basics?
Footwear.
Footwear is critical.
I agree with footwear.
And depending on where you're boating, like if you're boating in a really warm area where there's not really slick rocks, I think you can get away with having Chacos for a long time. Like if you're only boating the lower salmon or the main salmon in the summer, I think you can get away with wearing Chacos a lot. But if you're boating in the Pacific Northwest in the winter, grip is really important because falling on slick basalt rocks is probably more likely to injure you than swimming in some cases. And just keeping your feet warm is also a good reason to have good footwear.
I wanted to hit on the boating alone one.
Yeah, I kind of want to get back to that too. Let me tell you what I saw on Instagram. There's a company that does safe. It's a safety company or some company that teaches people how to boat. Let's just leave it at that. And they post on their Instagram, they bragged on their Instagram that they just finished a solo lap of some run. And I think that we shouldn't be encouraging solo boating. This shouldn't be something that people do and that we should see it as unsafe. If you want to go do it, rad, go do it. But I think that you shouldn't be bragging about solo boating. That's something that you've chosen to do by yourself, and then maybe you should keep to yourself. What do you guys think about that? Mm-hmm.
I think it's easy to put a blanket statement on things, especially when it comes to risks that we're not personally comfortable with or aware of. So like, I'll bring rock climbing into as an example. Solo rock climbing is obviously very, very dangerous, but culturally people celebrate it a lot as a great achievement of humans and, you know, this pure way to, you know, free solo, taking it even further, is this pure way to experience nature and to make no mistakes. And I think whitewater boating in a lot of ways in the public eye has so many risks that people don't understand. So then adding on top of all these things that people don't understand, doing it by yourself, the automatic response is that is so dangerous and irresponsible. Why would you ever do that? And same with, like, you know, you could argue doing anything alone in the outdoors is inherently dangerous. Like a woman hiking alone just got killed by a cougar. You know, people have skied alone and mountaineered alone and died. When you're alone, it's, you're increasing the risk in a certain way. But I think the way to be better about making people actually aware of what risks are involved and why people might solo boat and why they might not is education. And just to give an example of my own experience with solo boating is, so when I solo boat, I don't do anything hard, like as hard as I would with someone else. I solo boat for a few reasons. One being, if I'm in an area and I can't find anyone to boat with, it's a run that's class three and I've scouted from satellite imagery or trip reports or GoPro, I know what the risks are. I will probably decide to walk certain rapids if there's any chance that I'm going to flip upside down. So it makes me think more critically about the decisions I make on the water. It makes me more careful because I'm alone. But it also, like, when you're alone, you can surf at a wave for, you know, an hour if you want to and practice as long as you want to without feeling like, oh, I'm making these people wait. Or, you know, you can practice ferrying for an hour, which is what I often do when I'm by myself, just to practice skills without people having like a judging eye or you holding up a group. But what's more important is I'll often walk a lot of the river because I'll look at something that I would, you know, read and run with a group and be fine flipping over because I know there's a group. But if I'm by myself, I'm like, that's probably not really worth the risk. So I'm going to walk on the side of the river and just put in below it. And it's still a cool experience. But that being said, if you're not a person that has been in situations where you have to make these critical decisions and weigh risks and also just like make good decisions and not necessarily make the solo trip like about this ego based thing, like I'm so cool, I'm so good, I can solo a river, I think you have to evaluate whether that's actually a good decision. Just like someone who would do a backcountry trip by themselves or would free solo a climbing route, it's very similar decision making and very similar in terms of public perception. And I would never tell someone to solo boat is the other thing.
So but, what I hear you saying is you should do it well below your level. Like if you're a class four boater, you shouldn't solo boat class four.
Well, the way that I would put it is this, because I've been solo boating since I was like 11, and solo biking and solo backcountry skiing. And I, you know, there's times where I go do all of these things solo just because of like the schedule of my life. When I have free time, I don't mind doing it by myself. Sometimes I like doing it by myself, whatever. And the way I always think about it is there are circumstances that if you have one other person are not a big deal, but if you are by yourself are life-threatening. And you have to, regardless of the activity you're doing, so whether it's like backcountry skiing, a, you know, like small slough release, if you're with somebody else and you get knocked over and like partially buried, whatever, like not a big deal. Like, I mean, don't get me wrong, like I don't want that in my life, but like it's a survivable scenario. Whereas that same scenario by yourself can become life-threatening. And so you have to, like, you can have a small avalanche tolerance. You know, you got an airbag, all the stuff. You can have a little bit of a tolerance there, maybe, like, depending on your risk level. Like, if you have somebody else, the consequences are very different than if you're solo. And I think boating's the same way. Like, a swim on a class three rapid by yourself is potentially, the consequence of that is very different potentially than if you're with one other person. Getting your boat pinned with your by yourself, the consequences of that are potentially very different, and the likelihood of a bad outcome is extremely higher, much higher, if you're by yourself versus one other person. And so it's not necessarily looking at what my ability is like kind of across the board and, you know, what should I do, what shouldn't I do. To me, it's always an evaluation of what are the consequences if something goes wrong now that I'm alone. And you know, regardless of whether it's biking or whatever, like there's jumps I'll do on my bike with other people around that I won't do by myself, because if I go, you know, time a hawking off through the trees and I'm all alone, which I say because I've done, like all I can tell you is breaking your shoulder and having to walk your bike out by yourself super sucks. You know, and like that experience is applicable across the board of sort of these outdoor sports by yourself. Like the consequences are just so much higher that I'm an advocate for doing them by yourself, but just really weigh what you're doing. The same thing, like I think about taking out my kids and when I go boating with my kids, you know, I've got a 5 and a 9-year-old, almost 6 and 9-year-old. And the things that I will take them to go do, like I am not going to take them down things where there's even a chance that they're going to end up out of the boat. I mean, there's always a chance, right? But like, it is very, like, I am very safety conscious about taking them. I want to make sure those are all positive experiences. And like, if something goes wrong, I've got all these other things I've got to deal with. The consequences are much higher. So my risk assessment is all judged. I'm dictating my risk assessment based on the circumstances of what's going on. And solo boating is one of those things. Just like boating with, you know, small children or whatever else. You should change what you're doing.
Let me rephrase this a little bit then. The two of you are very experienced in the outdoors and you can make those assessments and make those judgments on your own. But there's people who aren't that experienced or getting into sports and they can't make those judgments. And so what do you think? I mean, so my take is that if we do this, cool, go do it. Maybe don't brag about it. Just do it. You know, like I think the beauty of doing a solo trip is that it's for yourself, not to like get home and tell people, hey, I did this solo thing. Like, do it for yourself, but we shouldn't be glorifying solo boating or bragging about it or promoting it. We should just be like, hey, it's not a good idea to do, and leave it at that. And that way when people go do it, they know that they're doing something they probably shouldn't be doing, and they'll take extra precaution.
Well, here's the way I would put it is, because I think that negative connotation is always tough, because then if somebody, like something goes wrong and somebody does, like something tragic happens, right? Then you have the entire outdoor community blaming this person for making bad choices. And that, to me, like, you end up vilifying people and demonizing them for things that we probably all do anyway. I look at it more as...
Wait, do you think everybody solo boats?
I think a lot of people solo boat.
Wow. If I was to guess, I would say less than 20% of paddlers. Like 10%. I would say less than 10%.
Playboating background. Like, playboating background, everybody solo boats.
Yeah, but like, you're not by yourself.
You can be. Like, I was just out on the salmon, like, 3 weeks ago at a very popular hole. But, like, on a, you know, middle of the day on a Monday, nobody else was there. I came back on a Saturday, there was 30 people there.
But isn't there a road nearby? Or I don't know. When I go play buddy by myself, there, you know, it's a play park, there's people there. I'm rarely like completely by myself.
Yes. But I'm just saying, like, I think there is
a
higher population thing, right? I look at it more as we should say boating by yourself or biking or skiing or whatever it is, like, is never the ideal. You should never say, like, I am super jacked to always go do this by myself. Like, that should not be my goal. But reality as well. Like, I'm not going to not go boating because I can't find somebody.
So here's what I ask you guys. When you solo boat, do you do it for the solo experience? Because there's a cool, like, heightened awareness and solo experience. Or is it more like, there's nobody else to go with, I might as well go? Or some combination of the two?
I would say 95% the latter. I don't need to prove to myself that I can do something alone. Like, I'm past that point in my life. Like, I would much rather go with other people. It's more fun. But my schedule and life just doesn't allow that sometimes.
Yeah. Priscilla?
Yeah. I think for me, it's similar to Eric, but then I have another component of, I would say, the learning aspect, where one, it's definitely a schedule thing where today I'm probably going to go do a solo flat water paddle for a workout, which I commonly do a few times a week. But if there was a white water, like the middle white salmon was, if I lived in Hood River, the middle white salmon would be that run that I would do by myself. And the amount of learning that I would be able to get from that experience doing it by myself is much higher than what I was talking about earlier, is like feeling self-conscious about practicing a certain technique in front of a group that I'm holding up. But I think you're totally right. We shouldn't brag about, like, and I feel this way about anything in action sports, is if your whole purpose for doing whatever X activity in X action sport is to brag on social media and to be cool, you're doing it for the wrong reasons. And that applies to solo boating, but that also applies to anything else. Like, there's a difference between sharing your experience with others and merely doing it to boost your ego. So don't be an ego booster, because that makes other people do it and usually is also attributed to people making bad decisions.
But I think that if we go solo boating, we should keep it to ourselves. That's my opinion. Like, if you go, don't even post the thing, hey, it was such a beautiful day by myself on the White Sandman. Like, that was your experience, and that promotes, that encourages people to do it that maybe shouldn't. Like, and that solo boating is a norm. And I don't think it's norm. I personally think it's an exception.
I think not. I hear what you're saying, but I slightly disagree. I think neglecting to talk about something, especially in an outdoor community where we often don't talk about rescues in the way that they actually happen. We talk about them again when they're cool. Like, look at this beat down, look at this beatery, versus actually talking about some of the stuff that went down, because it's more taboo for some reason. And I think when there's opportunities that I've seen, like Ben Stokesbury or Eric Boomer talking about scary scenarios and rescues and what they did and what they could do better in the future, that's more beneficial to the community. Yeah. Where in the case of solo boating, if you're taking the time to say, hey, I enjoyed this beautiful trip down the White Salmon by myself, and this is why, and it's an honest thing, and also saying, you know, not encouraging other people to do it, being honest and real about the risks associated with it, you create an environment where you have a more educated public that's less likely to try to do things to look cool or because they think they're a norm. So I think just being mindful about the information you're sharing and acknowledging that anytime you share something on social media, you have an impact on someone, and feeling a little bit responsible for that.
Priscilla, when you go solo boating on flat water this afternoon, are you going to bring a throw bag?
No. Because I am.
Because you're solo, or because it's flat water?
Because it's flat water. Okay. And like, if I was solo boating on the Middle White Salmon, I would definitely bring a throw rope. Okay. Or anything, you know, anything like that. If it's like Thomas Creek, which is a local class 3 run that nobody does, I would still bring a throw rope in the off chance that someone else is there. Okay. But on the Willamette, I'm pretty confident that I could boat to anyone swimming.
All right, we got to move on to gear of the week here, but final question on boating alone is it different rafting? Like, say you've got like two friends and you're going rafting in your one raft. Is that different than going kayaking by yourself? Like, is the alone component the separate boat that doesn't get hung up on the rock?
It's not different
or whatever. Like,
I think I saw a video of some guys R2-ing the wind, one boat trip on the wind, and they just were getting hammered. I saw this just last week, just getting super stuck on every rock. Maybe there's three of them in a boat. I think that we can probably make the case that solo kayaking is okay. You guys are convincing me. Like, I'm feeling okay. I get it. I'll go solo boat the Middle White Salmon and feel okay about it. Rafting might be different. Like, maybe you shouldn't do just one raft, especially on a run like the wind. I don't think adding a second person helps, because when the boat's pinned or stuck or messed up, that other person's not, it's not another boat that can help you out.
Yeah, I think it's situational. But like Zach's saying, if you're on the wind at higher water, which is a pretty continuous run, and the boat flips, in reality, there's no one that can really do anything for you, which is the essence of why solo boating is something not to be taken lightly or to be advertised as something that anyone should do, is like the likelihood of something going wrong and the inability to help oneself, I suppose. So if you're in a raft on a continuous run and you are only two people and you flip, there's maybe a similar potential for that.
I'm going to make a statement that I can't back up, and you guys are going to disagree with, but I'm going to make it anyway. I would say solo kayaking, I'm kind of okay with. I think that one raft trips people shouldn't do. I think there should always be a second boat when there's a raft involved. But we can debate this for 20 minutes. We don't have 20 minutes, so I'm making this claim without time to debate it.
Yeah.
Our listeners can debate it.
Yeah. Send us an email.
Like, the same rules for me on that would apply to everything else. Like, I'm going to choose runs or make decisions while I'm on a run based on what are the consequences of being alone.
Yeah,
that's going to happen here, right? Like, I've run the Rogue alone numerous times in a raft. Like solo trip going down, you know, but it's a run that I feel really, really comfortable on. Like, I'm not.
And there's
other people down.
Now that I think about it, I guess
it's not the win. Like, I wouldn't go run the win by myself.
I would do a one boat trip on the middle white. I guess I would do that. I would do one boat on the middle white salmon, but I wouldn't run Houston without a second boat.
But you wouldn't what?
Run Houston without the second boat.
Yeah. I mean, that's just a judgment of, you know. But I think back to the point of it, why I asked it, is that solo doesn't, like, the solo conversation doesn't just mean being alone or not being alone. I think, I'm with you, Zach. I think that the real kicker there is the number of boats, or like, if your craft gets screwed up, is there someone in another craft that's not in your craft that isn't now also a swimmer who's there to help you? Yeah. I think there's a lot of comparison to a two or three person full boat if they're the only boat as there is to a solo kayaker or a solo inflatable kayaker.
So I want to go back just a second. Yeah. We're going to beat this to death. I'm going to put that video in the show notes that I showed you guys of the one raft beatering down the wind. That just seems so sketchy to me. And I think that there's people who say it's okay to solo boat, and then people like this do that. And that these guys should not have been doing that. That was a bad judgment call on their part. And they were fine, but when you watch the video, it's pretty cringeworthy. And at many points along the way, they could have had been a yard sale with nobody to save them.
Yeah.
So I think that normalizing solo boating gives people the idea that they can just go run something like the wind by themselves.
Yeah. I think that's fair. I think that's fair for anything, too, is like normalizing running bigger waterfalls, that anyone can do it, resulting in people getting injured a lot because there's not an understanding for the consequences for it, or high water runs, or anything in boating that is normalized through social media runs the risk of reaching the wrong people and not having people honestly evaluate the risks that they're subjecting themselves and others to.
Yep, I agree.
All right. Well, should we move on to gear of the week?
Can you guys hear the dog drinking water right now?
We can, for sure.
Okay. That's funny.
Zach, do you have any gear of the week?
I will once you go. Why don't you go first? Yeah. I know you're excited.
So we just did the lower salmon last week. We did like a four-day trip and got to just pull out all the camping gear and all that kind of stuff, which was a lot of fun. And we set up and used, I think I've said these before, but like, I was just reminded how rad they are because we got a new set and they're really nice and I really like them. Whitewater Worthy makes this table setup where it's like a table on both sides with bars that go in between, and then there's hanging dish buckets that hang in the bars. And so you can like get your dishwater all set up, and then your buckets are there. They're totally out of the way. They're not taking up table space. And like, you're doing your dishes while you're cooking because you're not taking up your table space to set up your dish buckets, but they're collapsible. They don't take any space. Like, it's the best. I love it. It's like the greatest dish setup ever.
I can't picture this. Do you have a photo?
I like the sound of it.
If you go to the website, like Jake's website has them up there, Whitewater Worthy.
Okay.
And we'll get some pictures up, you know, try and put their link to it or something in the show notes. But think like table. And then in between those tables is, you know, 4 or 5 feet. And he's got two bars that connect the two tables. So like on, you know, the outsides of the table, like the bars connect. And so there's a gap in between. And he's got these, like, you know, the, think like the NRS collapsible buckets. So kind of like that, but they're designed to hang between those two bars. Hmm. And so you've got four of them, a big one for like your bigger dishes. And then, you know, sort of like your, what we call a yuck bucket, and then your soap and your bleach and your clean water. And they hang in between the tables. So you've got all this table space, you can be cooking whatever, and then you can just walk over and dip your bucket, dip them and go. But you're not sacrificing table space to set up your dish stuff. Hmm. Nice. They're awesome.
Is Whitewater worthy an Idaho company? There's a bunch of new Whitewater companies.
He's out of Central Point. Okay. Jake Wallace is out of Central Point.
Southern Oregon.
Is it a new company or been around for a while?
He's probably 4 years old, I would guess.
Okay.
He makes some burly stuff. Like, everything that Jake makes is like over the top.
How do you buy it?
You can go to his website. I mean, I go to his compound in Central Point and pick it up. and compound is for sure the right word.
Can you buy it somewhere else? Can you buy it at Sotar, or is it just only through him?
I don't think so. I think it's one of those.
So I thought Sotar used to carry some of his stuff, like when he first started. I don't know if they even have a retail store anymore, though.
I don't know, but he makes some really cool creative fire pans. He makes this table setup. He sews some things, like he's got this bag thing. We don't use it, but I've always been intrigued by it. Where, you know how we have a beaver tail in the back of the boat and you stack your stuff and then you like we strap it all down in the back. He's got this like giant bag thing that straps into the back of your boat and sits on your, you know, platform on the bottom.
Yeah, Pete loves those.
And you just fill the bag and then like
muffin
tie it
tops.
Off.
Pete calls them muffin tops. Yeah,
that's exactly what it is. I've never used it, but I've always thought it was intriguing. Jake comes up with some of that kind of stuff. But the table thing is legit. The first version wasn't as good. We're now on the second version, and it's like it's bomber. We've used it for one full year of commercial use. It looks brand new. Like, it's awesome.
It's cool.
So, you know, Whitewater worthy tables.
You know, I have to say, I think there's a bunch of new companies coming out right now making quality gear. I think that we have like the NRSs and all the companies that have been around for a while that are just kind of skating by on like the same old stuff. But companies like this one, that Super Guide throwback thing that I'm way into right now. And just like new people getting after it, making high quality things, I think it's really good for the industry. So I'm glad to hear this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Priscilla, do you have gear of the week?
So you guys have gear of the week?
Yeah. So my gear of the week is also rafting related. It was introduced to me by a friend. It's called the Captain's Bag. It's by Downriver Equipment. You can get it at Cascade River Gear. But basically, it's this little zipper pouch that it's not waterproof, but it's this little I don't know, what is it, polyethylene or mesh bag, I don't know what the fabric is, but it attaches to the frame kind of right next to where a rower would be, and you can stick like your sunscreen, your water bottle, like all the stuff that's normally kind of just floating around in the bottom of the boat when you're doing a multi-day trip or have people on your boat, into this captain's bag. And I thought it was way over the top and totally unnecessary. And I guess it probably is. But the convenience of having that was so awesome. You could put your, like, if it's a sunny weather trip, like putting your Chacos in there and just going barefoot in the boat so they're not flopping around it, or you don't have to use a carabiner, putting your hat in there.
I never run barefoot, Priscilla, ever.
Oh, right.
Barefoot, remember?
Yeah, totally.
Dare you.
Yeah, totally. Gross. Captain's Bag by Downriver Equipment. If you need something that's totally unnecessary but super satisfying to have in your raft, highly recommend.
I've seen these in boats and I've been super jealous, but I can't get myself to buy one.
They do a lot of cool
stuff.
They're
like $80.
Yeah. I've been really impressed with Downriver in that since, I feel like in the last 5, 6, 7 years, whatever, they've really come out with some cool sort of creative, like, we're going to try something different, try this. And like, there's been some flops, I think, but there's been some really cool stuff where they've sort of driven some changes in like frame design and stuff in really good ways.
I'm going to put them in that category I mentioned earlier of innovating. I just bought a bunch of their wishy-washies because they're doing a really good job with their wishy-washies, the hand wash things.
Yeah, agreed.
Oh,
I really like
wishy-washies.
Yeah, they make really good ones.
Yeah. I had multiple people. I had a guest who came on a trip with us last summer. They went on a trip with another outfitter, and he called me to say, you should buy this wishy-washy. It's better than yours. And so I, Downriver's doing a good job with that.
Yeah.
Nice.
Cool, awesome. Zach, you got any gear?
I got nothing. I'm trying to think of something. I'm
what?
Kind of. I know. I usually have something exciting to talk about. But I guess scarves is my gear of the week. Have you guys ever worn a scarf kayaking?
Oh, man. I know that you love your scarf.
It's delightful. You can get a wool scarf. You can get it totally wet, and it still keeps you warm. So
is it wool?
Wool, 100% wool. I highly recommend
wool
scarves on cold days for kayaking.
I'm full on shaking my head at you right now.
Until you try it. I have a green wall scarf that I wear through every run to Green Wall now.
I wore my buff last week. I wore my buff on the Lower Salmon last week.
Same
up
thing.
In Raft where I was dry. And it was awesome. It was really nice when it was cold. Well, actually, I wasn't even on a raft. I was on our snout boat and I was motoring. And so when the wind would get there when I was motoring along, it was awesome.
Yeah.
But I wasn't in a kayak. I was up in dry. And so it seemed nice. I feel like a scarf, I feel like it was going to strangle me. Like, I don't.
It's not going to strangle
gets
you.
Wet, it gets wet and heavy. And it just.
It does get wet and heavy. And you would think it would be miserable, but it actually still keeps you warm.
Or do you like tucking the ends under your PFD?
I do. Yeah. Like, I do.
But that looks really awesome too. But it looks super good.
I don't know how it looks. I have to tell you, every time you wear a scarf kayaking, people like think it's funny. It's like wearing dare wear. Like, oh, look at you. You're so funny. And then about 5 minutes into it, nobody cares anymore. And it's delightful.
Awesome. Scarfs, the new kayaking craze.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to catch on. But I highly recommend trying it if you get cold and paddling in the winter.
Awesome. Sweet. Well, thanks for hanging out and listening. Hopefully you were going boating and you found some water somewhere. If not, hopefully it comes soon. You get out to go boating when there is water. Otherwise, tell your friends, rate us on iTunes, hopefully positively, but you know, be honest, I guess, too. You'll be able to find links to today's topics and maybe some pictures of Zach wearing scarves on our website at therivertalkpodcast.com. And please shoot us an email at therivertalkpodcast@gmail.com. We will most likely read it, respond to it, whatever, because we don't get very many. And yeah, we'll see you next time around.